I'm Lisa Mullins.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and we have lots of news for you today, from the trial of Paul Manafort to the death of the Queen of Soul, Aretha Franklin. But we start this hour in Florida, where, as one reporter put it, red tide is killing the Southwest coast. Red tide is a toxic algae bloom, a regular occurrence in Florida, but this year's is so much worse. Governor Rick Scott has declared a state of emergency for 7 counties along the Gulf of Mexico. Scott, a Republican, is running to unseat Democratic Senator Bill Nelson in November, and the two are blaming each other for the disaster. Meanwhile, millions of pounds of dead fish have washed up on Florida's shores. People's livelihoods are threatened. Rachel Wells is general manager and lead tour guide for Riding the Waves Eco Tours in Englewood, Florida. Rachel, how bad is it?
It is definitely the worst I have seen my whole life living here in Florida.
Yeah.
It has affected not only our marine life, our coastal ecosystems, but people's health are now in jeopardy, and also our economy is suffering terribly.
Well, people's health, it's hard to breathe. There's a stench from the dead animals. Is there another way it might be affecting people's health?
Well, the fact that we can't even get out to the beach to enjoy the luxury of walking the beach, swimming in the ocean, observing the wildlife in their natural habitat, it all just kind of wears on you and really makes you appreciate Florida's clean water, and when we do have clean water here.
Right. So you can't do the things that make you feel healthy either, which is terrible. And you say affecting the business, it's affected yours.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. We have ran 3 tours since the first week of July. And we've had to lay off all 7 of our employees. I am the only one on staff currently.
Yeah. Tour guides, office workers, there's maybe a dock hand there.
Correct.
Yeah, but that's it. And was this because you felt you had to stop, or did people stop coming?
Yeah. I mean, if we won't physically expose ourselves to the water, we can't encourage visitors to potentially expose them to unhealthy water conditions. We just don't feel it's the right thing to do, and we're trying to take the high road here.
Yeah. Have you seen some of the dead wildlife?
Oh, yes. Unfortunately, it is absolutely heartbreaking. We've had 2 dead manatees pulled in here to the marina that we work at. I've seen dead sea turtles out there on the beaches, hundreds and hundreds of dead fish surrounding our bayside waterways.
Oh, terrible. There's been dolphins killed, and manatees are huge, and so it just...
They are. They're little gentle giants, well, big gentle giants, and to see them dying due to the toxic algae blooms, it's heartbreaking.
Yeah. Well, as we said, this is algae. It happens all up and down the coast at different times. But this is incredibly bad. And as you probably know, researchers are pointing at human activity, things like nitrogen-rich materials like fertilizer that run off into waters. Mm-hmm. And this is the fertilizer that's used all over your coast for sugarcane, tomato, corn growth. This feeds the algae. When the nitrogen gets to the ocean, the algae grows. And, of course, there's climate change. Rising temperatures mm-hmm. drive it. And researchers at the University of Florida and the University of North Carolina say climate change will severely affect the ability to control blooms and in some cases could make it impossible. Are you worried that because of climate change, this is the new normal?
We're hoping that this is not the new normal. And myself, as well as other local businesses, we're trying to bring awareness to the situation and try and have people take responsibility for our daily actions and then force other businesses to take responsibility so that this does not become Florida's new normal.
Yeah. What would you tell people who are hearing this and are thinking, I'm not coming?
Well, I would say become educated on the situation. If you're able to relocate your vacation plans, maybe to an area that's not being directly affected, that might be a great suggestion for people. But if you do come to the area, support our local businesses in one way or the other. We're really hurting down here. We really are. But we're all trying to be on the same page and working together to bring awareness and push for immediate action to be taken.
Yeah. And again, you talk about what you can do on a local level. But as you know, there's a big dust up politically over this. Governor Scott is blaming Senator Nelson. Senator Nelson is blaming Governor Scott. They're both mm-hmm. you know, running in the midterms in the fall. What would you like to say to them?
this is a big election year for Florida, and this is going to be a turning point. And at the moment, a lot of us locals and people living here in Florida, we are putting parties to the side, and we're saying we need someone that is going to prioritize clean water for Florida. That is what we're looking for, and that's what we absolutely need to have.
That's Rachel Wells, General Manager, Lead Tour Guide for Riding the Waves, a boat tour company based in Englewood on Florida's southwest coast. Keep them in mind, you know. But Rachel, we just wish you the best.
Thank you so much. We really appreciate you taking the time.
Two women accused of killing the half-brother of North Korea's leader, Kim Jong-un, will stand trial for the crime. A judge in Malaysia today said there is evidence of conspiracy in the attack on Kim Jong-nam last year at the airport in Kuala Lumpur. The BBC's Jonathan Head is in Kuala Lumpur. And Jonathan, this was a very bizarre attack. Can you remind us what happened?
Well, Kim Jong-nam was, of course, the estranged half-brother of the current North Korean leader, Kim Jong-un. At one time, he was, in fact, the designated successor, but had been confined to obscurity, living in the gambling enclave of Macau near China. And he was traveling through Malaysia, actually leaving Malaysia at the main international airport in February last year, went up to a policeman, a security officer, and complained that he was feeling unwell and that two women had smeared a liquid on his face. Within about 20 minutes, he was dead, and the Malaysians discovered who he was. He was traveling on a false passport, and that he had been exposed to the deadly nerve agent, VX. And using the airport security videos, they were able to identify these two young women, one from Indonesia, one from Vietnam, who they believe carried out the attack. They were arrested. But of course, it's far more complicated than that. There were North Korean men also seen in that video who left Malaysia the same day and who are believed to be North Korean agents. There are others linked to the attack who hold up in the North Korean embassy here in Malaysia, but were eventually allowed to leave when North Korea held Malaysian diplomats effectively hostage in Pyongyang. And we've been left with this extraordinary assassination, but just these two women on trial for premeditated murder, for which they could get the death penalty if found guilty. Their lawyers say they had no idea what they were doing. They were recruited and thought they were taking part in televised pranks for which they were quite well paid. And they had no idea that the substance they smeared on Kim Jong-nam was actually this nerve agent.
So does anyone actually believe that they were acting alone to try and murder the brother of North Korea's president? Is there any direct tie back to the president himself?
The North Korean government has completely denied any involvement. They've even denied that the man who died was, in fact, Kim Jong-nam, the North Korean leader's half-brother. The judge ruling on the evidence today said that he felt there was enough evidence. You know, the way it was carried out and the use of this deadly nerve agent definitely suggests the involvement of a state like North Korea or of a very powerful entity. We don't know what the motive is, but it is possible, although he hadn't been politically active for many years, that he was perceived as a threat by his half-brother. We simply don't know. It was a very brazen attack carried out in Malaysia's very busy international airport, of course, posing a great risk at the time to travelers.
Right. And to the women themselves, did the women get sick if they were handling or allegedly handling this deadly nerve agent?
No, they didn't. And it is interesting there were no ill effects. One of the bits of evidence that the judge cited to justify charging the two women was that they're seen going to the bathroom very quickly afterwards, apparently to wash their hands. And the judge believes that suggests they knew that what they were handling was a deadly nerve agent. Their lawyers say, no, they were told to do that. And all the pranks they carried out, they were given strict instructions how to handle them, and that they genuinely believed the liquids were harmless. And the defense will now have a full opportunity to make their own case that these women were, in fact, unwitting pawns in a North Korean conspiracy.
And if indeed this does go back to the president of North Korea, Kim Jong-un, he has a history, as did his father, of doing away with family members who crossed him in some way or seemed to threaten him. Is anyone going that route of trying to hold him responsible for this, or is it just these two women?
It is just these two women, and the defense team are very frustrated by this. But it is remarkable how, although there was a good deal of anger last year when this shocking attack took place in Malaysia, the Malaysian government at the moment is saying nothing about North Korea's involvement. The prosecution have barely mentioned North Korea, despite the very strong evidence of its involvement. I've talked to Malaysian officials about this, and they say it's a matter of realpolitik, that although they've frozen relations with North Korea since this attack last year, they're now actually restoring them because they say in this region you have to have some kind of diplomatic relationship with North Korea. Malaysia is not seeking to punish or hold North Korea to account at all. Many people are surprised by this, but it does seem as though they want the diplomatic spat between the two countries to be put aside as soon as possible. And that leaves these two women from very poor backgrounds in their own countries as the only two who are being held accountable for this shocking assassination.
BBC's Jonathan Head in Kuala Lumpur. Thank you, Jonathan.
Good to talk to you. Thank you.
Aretha Franklin died this morning at the age of 76 after a battle with pancreatic cancer. The undisputed Queen of Soul sang with unmatched style on classics such as Think, I Say a Little Prayer, and her signature song, Respect. Franklin died at her home outside Detroit. A statement from her family read in part, "In one of the darkest moments of our lives, we're not able to find the appropriate words to express the pain in our heart. We have lost the matriarch and rock of our family." We're going to begin our remembrance in Washington, D.C. Aretha Franklin had a deep connection to the city. Michaela Lafrak of member station WAMU has more.
Franklin was a daughter of Detroit, but D.C. loved her too. She sang at the first inaugurations of the last three Democratic presidents, Jimmy Carter, Bill Clinton, and Barack Obama, the country's first black president. She sang My Country, 'Tis of Thee at his 2009 inauguration, putting her personal stamp on the patriotic song. Two years later, Franklin performed at the dedication of the long-awaited memorial to Martin Luther King Jr. in West Potomac Park. She sang Precious Lord, the same gospel song she performed at King's memorial service in 1968.
Precious Lord, take my. Gospel
was part of her repertoire from the very beginning of her career nearly six decades ago. Franklin's performances in Washington included appearances at the White House and Kennedy Center. She filled its expansive halls with her rich and soaring voice. The president of the Kennedy Center, Deborah Rutter, says Franklin had become more than just a famous singer.
They're people who have sustained success throughout their career. But at a certain point, an artist takes on an even greater role as a communicator and one that you want to have present at important occasions.
Rutter saw Franklin perform at the Kennedy Center as part of a tribute to songwriter Carole King in 2015. The Queen of Soul brought the black tie crowd to its feet when she threw off her floor-length fur coat halfway through Natural Woman.
It took the breath away from everybody in the room. It was so exhilarating. And that's who she was.
During the song, King alternated between singing along, crying, and wildly flapping her hands. President Obama famously shed a tear at the performance. Franklin's final show in the Washington region was not for a major event. It was a concert at Wolf Trap in Vienna, Virginia last year. She looked thinner than before, but still had that marvelous voice. For Here and Now, I'm Michaela Lafrak.
We're going to turn now to Mark Anthony Neal, professor of black popular culture at Duke University. And Mark Anthony, I'm told that you recall seeing Aretha perform live for the first time when you were something like 5 years old.
My parents took me to see Aretha Franklin at the Apollo Theater in 1971. She did a week-long stayed there at the Apollo Theater. Famously, you'll see on the facade, there are photos of it. She's home, Aretha Franklin. And that wasn't my first introduction to her, but that was the first time, of course, I had a chance to see her live.
You were a lucky kid. The term Queen of Soul almost seems an understatement for the impact that she had over the decades. Could you define her impact?
I would argue Queen of Soul is really a misnomer. She came to prominence, obviously, as kind of the face of soul music as it became this mainstream cultural phenomenon. But, I describe her as the greatest American singer of the 20th century, in part because of her mastery of multi-genres. So this is a woman who, of course, comes up in the black church, but she's also deeply steeped in the blues. She also has the capacity to sing gospel, as we know, soul music. But she also was adept at singing jazz. She could sing pop standards alongside Barbra Streisand, who was her label mate in the 1960s before she moved to Atlantic. When she does that time at the Fillmore West, she's singing, basically hippie rock music to an audience of hippies. I mean, she had this capacity to be able to own any song and any genre in which she added her voice to.
Well, Mark Anthony, the one she probably truly owned, brought it home and owned it, was, of course, Respect. And I just want your thoughts on that. We're going to listen to a little. Written and originally released by Otis Redding in 65, he sang it as a man. He wanted respect when he got home from his woman. She takes it in 67, gives it a whole new spin, adds the R-E-S-P-E-C-T. Let's just listen.
What you want?
She added the shaka to me. That was her version. And this was before the women's movement, had really taken steam. It's almost like she propelled it with this song.
Yeah, you always have to remember, it is Otis Redding's song.
Right.
The way that she literally stops and spells out respect, even though it wasn't a political song, it had resonance amongst African Americans as a political song,
right.
And obviously becomes an obvious reference when we start to see the women's movement find its own footing in the late 1960s and early 1970s. Otis Redding famously said, after he heard her version of the song, "That gal done stole my song." But then he goes, "She's a friend, so it's okay."
She had, of course, really deep roots in gospel. She would perform at the Baptist churches where her father was preaching. Let's listen to one particular song. I know you like this one, "Mary, Don't You Weep." She's performing here with the Southern California Community Choir. Tell us what you hear in that.
"Mary, Don't You Weep" was a classic recording done by the Caravans in 1958. Caravans were gospel music's first supergroup. Within them, they had Inez Andrews. They also had Shirley Caesar. The pianist for the group was the Reverend James Cleveland. And so she's in this church in Los Angeles, basically returning to her gospel roots and paying tribute to all the folks who had helped her become the voice that she became. Sitting in the front row was the great Clara Ward, who was her greatest influence. Clara Ward of the Clara Ward Singers. She was Aretha's greatest influence. So this is an opportunity for her, at the height of her fame, to acknowledge the roots that her career was grounded in.
I'm thinking, Lisa, we should ask listeners. We'd love to know what your favorite Aretha Franklin song is. I'm thinking, "Think," "Don't Play That Song," how she sang "Oh Christmas Tree." But you wanted to hear "Bridge Over Troubled Water." Let's listen to her version of Simon and Garfunkel's hit.
When you're look up and see yourself on the street.
Recorded live at Fillmore West, 1971. Mark Anthony, she made songs her own.
Yes, again, as you said, this is a Simon and Garfunkel song. She does three nights at the Fillmore West in 1971. Jerry Wexler, who was a producer at the time, literally says, "Let's go conquer the hippies." And so in this crowd of hippies, literally, she takes standards of that era and transforms them into something that was just something else. That same three-night stand at Fillmore West, she does a song called Spirit in the Dark, in which she's joined on stage by Ray Charles. It is just an amazing tribute to who she was and who she was able to reach. And she earned a whole new audience with that successful stand at the Fillmore West in 71.
We heard in the previous story that incredible performance, or part of it, from 2015. Hard to believe it was just 3 years ago at the Kennedy Center Awards honoring Carole King. And Aretha was singing the song that King and Jerry Goffin wrote for her in Natural Woman. Yeah. It was, I mean, if anybody hasn't seen the video, it is really breathtaking. But there are so many classic songs, beautiful songs, one including this one, I Never Loved a Man. This was by Ronnie Shannon. So one final question. We only have about 30 seconds left. Tell us what younger listeners of today have to learn about how Aretha worked songs like that one.
She performed for 60 years. She had a 60-year career. And even as her voice changed and matured and became more weathered, it sounded different, but she was in such control of her instrument that she still was absolutely brilliant, as we heard in 2015.
Mark thank Anthony you. Neal of Duke University, just thank you so much.
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
A large-scale drug overdose is rocking New Haven, Connecticut today, and it's a drug you might not suspect, synthetic marijuana, or K2. It's also called spice or black mamba. Synthetic cannabinoids are chemicals made in a lab and sprayed onto dried plant material to be smoked or vaporized. But dozens of people in and around a large park area in the city's downtown in New Haven experienced increased heart rates, vomiting, some were unconscious, ambulance swarmed, people said it looked like a war zone. There have been other incidents this year linked to synthetic marijuana around the country, including in Illinois. We're joined now by Dr. Jenny Liu, an emergency room doctor at Cook County Hospital. And Dr. Liu, when you heard about what happened in New Haven, were you surprised?
You know what? We have these epidemics once in a while, and actually we had our own epidemic here in Chicago where we, synthetic cannabinoids were laced with rat poison and causing some life-threatening bleeding. Yeah. But, you know, it's always terrible to hear, you know, about these types of epidemic outbreaks.
Well, in cases where this happens, I mean, New Haven is still being unraveled, but is that usually the case, that it's not the synthetic marijuana, it's something in it?
You know, when we have epidemics like this, you know, we really look at the clinical picture of the patient, their vital signs, and some of the physical findings. And from that, we can determine whether or not there is, you know, an additional substance on top of the synthetic cannabinoids that may be causing the epidemic.
And I guess it adds to the thinking that marijuana, synthetic marijuana, you know, it isn't always benign.
That's absolutely true. You know, you don't know what you're buying. These are laboratory-made chemicals, which are intended to produce effects which are similar to marijuana, but because they're unregulated, you do not know what you're getting. So a lot of the symptoms can actually be very unpredictable. They can actually also be life-threatening.
Yeah. And is there an antidote?
An antidote for synthetic cannabinoid overdose?
Yeah.
No, there are no antidotes that we know about.
Well, in the case that you described, rat poison was involved. So,
correct.
You know, immediately figure that out. And, you know, the scene that we're hearing about in New Haven, it just one after another, people falling, and that immediate sense, you're an emergency room doctor. What is the first thing you'd look for if somebody said to you, well, I was just doing synthetic marijuana, I don't know what happened here?
The first thing we try to figure out is what symptoms they're having. From that point, you know, we can see if there's what we call a toxidrome, which can lead us to, you know, a certain conclusion about what might be causing it. For example, you know, if they come with respiratory depression or they're comatose, this leads us to suspect an opioid-like substance. Mm-hmm. And depending on, you know, if they respond to the antidote, which is naloxone, this can also help support the conclusion that it might be an opioid-like substance.
Right. Whereas if there's bleeding or something, you might be thinking about a poison.
Right. When there's bleeding and, you know, especially life-threatening bleeding, and we can do lab tests to see whether or not there's a particular type of bleeding disorder and, you know, treat accordingly. Mm.
Doctors like you have to be concerned about this because, you know, people are drawn to synthetic marijuana because it's harder to prove it's illegal.
Correct. These are substances which are not detected in our standard urine drug screens. This is why it can be attractive to many people to, you know, for abuse.
Yeah. Dr. Jenny Liu at Cook County Hospital there in Chicago, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
A deeply disturbing report issued by a grand jury this week details 70 years of sexual abuse by Catholic priests in six dioceses in Pennsylvania, incidents that were covered up by the church. More than 300 priests were identified as abusers, and more than 1,000 people were reported to be victims. James Faluzak was one of the witnesses to testify before the grand jury. He was abused by a priest when he was a child. Eventually, he joined the priesthood but has now left the ministry. James Faluzak, thank you for speaking with us.
Thank you, Lisa.
What was your reaction when you saw the report that came out this week about the decades of sexual abuse by priests in Pennsylvania?
My first reaction was relief and a sense of vindication. I had been looking for decades for an avenue to share my material, what happened to me as a kid, and what I observed as a priest. And so the grand jury was an opportunity for me and for other victims really to have our voice finally be heard.
Were you surprised by the number of victims the grand jury identified, and were you surprised by the depravity of the incidents that were reported?
The depravity of the abuse, I can't even describe my reaction to that.
Was it surprising?
Shocking. It wasn't simply a matter of adult men having sex with children. It was the context of it, that these were men of God, and often they used religious symbolism as part of the abuse. And as a religious person, it seemed almost diabolical to me.
Can you help us understand that kind of thing? I think people who are religious, people who are not religious, would find this vile. Did you ever witness anything like this? And could you help us understand what was happening?
Well, I was molested by my childhood pastor from the time I was 16 to 19 years old. I knew him from the time that I was 5 years old, and he spent all of those intervening years grooming me for the moment when he knew that I would be the most vulnerable. So I can say I witnessed this firsthand.
He was part of your neighborhood parish. You know that he understood that you had difficulties at home because he was the priest who would receive the confession from members of your family.
Exactly. My mom and dad trusted him, and I trusted him. I went to him for my first confession. all of the priests in our parish were really part of the neighborhood. They were part of the fabric of the neighborhood. Church was a central location, not just to worship, but for us kids to play. And so he always seemed to know what I was up to, but he also knew what was going on in my family, because as you said, he heard all of our confessions.
So at what point did you come forth with the abuse that you suffered?
Oh, I mentioned it multiple times over the years to priests that I trusted, priests who were my friends, priests who were in charge of me in the seminary. I brought my experience to Bishop Donald Troutman in 2010. I brought this allegation and actually two others to Bishop Lawrence Persico, the current Bishop of Erie, over a span of time from October 31st, 2013, until well into February 2016.
And what was the bishop's response?
He totally ignored my claims.
Did he say it didn't happen? Did he challenge you?
He certainly treated me as if it was nothing. He didn't take it seriously. When I told him that Father Martin molested me 15 times, he couldn't even bring himself to say that he was sorry that that happened to me. By the time I spoke to Bishop Persico, I really wasn't talking to him about what happened to me, what Father Martin did to me, because I had come to terms with it. I can't say I was at peace with it or any way near getting over it. I'm still not. But I was more concerned about other allegations of child endangerment, of misconduct in the seminary that affected children and future priests. I was more concerned about how he would respond to that.
You mentioned Father Martin. This is Monsignor Daniel Martin of your local church. Bishop Lawrence Persico, who you are speaking of the Erie, Pennsylvania diocese, testified before this grand jury. We should say that most past and current bishops did not cooperate and would not testify. Bishop Persico was on All Things Considered yesterday afternoon, and here's part of the interview we want to play you now. He was speaking with NPR's Audie Cornish.
After the clergy sex abuse scandal in Boston many years ago, why would you be surprised? I mean, isn't the sense right now that there are many years of abuse that were not reported within the Catholic Church and that that's not uncommon?
Well, back in 2002, we thought we were moving in the right direction and that these things would be handled properly. However, as you said earlier, these are cases going back 70 years. And when you put them all together for all six dioceses, you just begin to see how tragic this whole thing was. And also the fact that it could have been handled better.
So Erie was your diocese. I wonder if you can tell us what your response is to that.
The only polite way that I can put it, and this is still a harsh assessment of those words that we just heard, I think Bishop Persico is styling himself as somehow transparent or outside of the norm of the other bishops in the state of Pennsylvania or in the country. But I can say that when I told him about Father Martin, he did not enact the investigatory protocols established by the American bishops in 2002. He never had the independent review board contact me. And furthermore, I brought two other sets of allegations to him. He did nothing to investigate a lay teacher who had a known history of molesting students in a high school where I was the vice president for Catholic Mission. This was an instance of child endangerment, I think, on Bishop Persico's part.
Can you explain why he would not respond, why you think that so many members of the hierarchy of the church would look the other way?
I think that they're concerned about their image. I think they're concerned about their assets. I don't think that they have regard for the most vulnerable members of their communities.
I wonder what you would want to see from the Catholic Church in response to this report. What do you think should be done and can be done?
They need to open up their administrative structures, their decision-making mechanisms to the light of day. These cases and the case files of priests, the personnel files of priests, should not be overseen just by the chancery staff or even by what Bishop Persico yesterday referred to as an independent review board. It's far from independent. These are people selected by the bishop. Go to the local DA or go to the local chief of police or the FBI office and ask for people like that to sit on these boards so that you can say that they're truly independent and not in the employ of the diocese or the bishop.
Are you still a Catholic?
Absolutely.
Because?
I have a sense that God has a relationship with me, that I have a relationship with Christ, and that is mediated through ritual, and so the rituals of the church are still important to me. But I feel that I approach the church more as an adult and more on my own terms than as somebody who does so blindly.
James Feluzak is a former priest. He was abused by a priest as a child. He was one of the witnesses who testified before the grand jury in Pennsylvania about sexual abuse by Catholic priests. James Feluzak, thank you.
Thank you, Lisa.
A few minutes now on two stories involving universities, their football programs, and coaches. This week, the University of Maryland admitted mistakes were made by the football team's training staff in connection with the death of 19-year-old Jordan McNair, who collapsed from a heat stroke during practice on May 29th, died on June 13th. Then there's Urban Meyer, the head football coach at Ohio State. He's on administrative leave while the school investigates how he handled domestic abuse allegations against one of his assistant coaches. Mike Pesca is here now, sports analyst. He hosts the daily podcast, The Gist, at Slate.com. Mike, start with Maryland. The university's president, Wallace Lowe, had this to say on Tuesday.
The university accepts legal and moral responsibility for the mistakes that our training staff made on that fateful workout day of May the 29th.
Mike Pesca, what happened to Jordan McNair? What mistakes were made on that day?
Well, May 29th was the date of the workout, and the players were made to do 100-yard sprints, a series of them. And McNair, who's an offensive lineman, started to have seizures, and he started to show evidence of heat stroke. And there was, according to EMT records, an hour lapse between him showing effects of heat stroke and the EMT actually being called and arriving when he went to the hospital when he was dead. He had a body temperature of 106 degrees. Mm-hmm. So there are procedures that they should have known if someone is showing signs of heat stroke. Furthermore, the strength and conditioning coach of the program had a reputation, as many strength and conditioning coaches do, for being very hard on his players, for pushing them. And in a certain mm-hmm. population of 19-year-olds who are overweight by BMI standards, even though they might be in good shape, you're going to get complications. You should know how to avoid them, and you should also know how to deal with them.
Yeah, because this isn't a first. Let's listen to another clip from Maryland's President Lowe, who met with Jordan McNair's family on Tuesday.
I said to the family, the university owes you an apology. You entrusted Jordan to our care, and he is never returning home again.
Mike, does he owe them more than an apology? Jordan McNair's family says the toxic culture of the football program, which was documented by ESPN, contributed to their son's death. Coach DJ Durkin should be fired.
Yeah, he may wind up owing them many millions of dollars, in fact. The mm-hmm. idea of in loco parentis, where the university takes care of the child, has been tested by law. But this is exactly what college coaches tell recruits. Hey, come to us. Every single coach says this. We're not just a team. We're a family. And therefore, the failing is doubly so. And I think not just Maryland, but every college team should, though I doubt they will, look at the institution of the strength and conditioning coach. Because how it works is you're not allowed allowed, the head coach is not allowed to oversee spring practices. So they have the strength and conditioning coach run drills, for instance. And this can lead and has led to tragedy in this case, but complications in others.
Yeah. Okay. Ohio State, a case that turns on what Urban Meyer, the coach there, knew about the domestic abuse allegations against his assistant coach, Zach Smith, no longer with Ohio State. Where does this stand?
Urban Meyer is the fourth highest coach, gets paid about $7.5 million a year in college football, and one of the best, is suspended. There's a chance he could be fired, which I think even a year or two ago, people would not think there was a chance. So maybe we're not having enough of a consciousness change about how to deal with domestic abuse, but we're having enough so that once it's dealt with poorly, there can be some consequences. Or maybe I'm wrong. Maybe Urban Meyer will skate beyond. We also should note the police did not charge Smith, the assistant coach. And this is one of those kind of cruel ironies in all these cases. People come down on the NFL or people come down on the coaching staff or the schools, and they should. But so often there's actually no criminal charge. And not only is that a disservice to the victim, it's one of the defenders of the coach will say, well, how is it his fault? There wasn't even a charge for domestic abuse. Yeah. So it's societal.
But in this case, have I got this right? The abused woman, the wife, says is the one saying that Urban Meyer knew.
Oh, yeah. She says that she told Urban Meyer's wife and that she must have known. And there's also the fact that Urban Meyer acknowledges lying at a media day or a press conference about how much he knew. And the wife went above and beyond to document these claims first to the police, which didn't go anywhere, and then to members of the media. In fact, an ESPN staffer who was fired by ESPN and then got the scoop of his lifetime and has been working to get this story more attention. Without the wife standing up and pointing the finger, this wouldn't be a story.
And without, you know, people like that, as you said, the ESPN reporter, I like that's a happy ending. And, you know, Christine Brennan writes, Urban Meyer, DJ Durkin have failed as football coaches and as human beings. I mean, it's a broader story.
Yeah. But again, they failed as human beings. I do not know how many coaches would have done something differently than what these coaches did. Yeah. I don't know. I haven't seen any evidence of a coach saying you're fired because there's an allegation that the police didn't bring charges against.
Yeah.
Never seen that.
Mike Pesca here, Now Sports Analyst, editor of the new book, Upon Further Review, The Greatest What-Ifs in Sports History. Mike, thanks as always.
You're welcome.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Robin Young.
And I'm Lisa Mullins. This is Here and Now.